after the New Deal, there was a long period of time where we were fighting about those New Deal type issues. And on the things that rise to the top of the salience list, the impact, the high impact issues at any moment in time, most people will have liberal or conservative positions on those, even if they have cross positions on other things that are less important. So that doesn't mean that there are no moderates. In fact, most people are moderates. Most Democrats are moderates. Most Republicans will say they're moderates. That, you know, it's sort of very useful to think about the six or seven things that each of these elections is turning on. And in that case, most voters have a clear alignment with one or the other party, even if ideologically they are not a super conservative or a super liberal.
This is Wally Knox. Welcome to the Political Conversation. Lynn Vavreck is the Marvin Hoffenberg Professor of American Political Science at UCLA. In 2019 and 2020, she was the leader of a massive survey project called Nationscape. Over the scope of a year and a half, they interviewed 500,000 of us, probing our political convictions and how we were deciding to vote. That report forms the basis of her new book, The Bitter End, in which she and her co-authors John Sides and Chris Towsanovich lay out a chronicle of the 2020 presidential election. Her book reads like a novel chronicling the events of the 2020 election: the pandemic, the murder of George Floyd, the defeat of Donald Trump, the triumph of Joe Biden, and in the course of that finds detailed statistical ways to test a whole host of questions that the election spawned. And also in the course of presenting that history, she lays out a new theory about the structure of our political lives. She calls her view calcification, and she has written a truly remarkable book. Professor Vavreck, welcome to the Political Conversation.
Thank you, Wally. It's great to be here.
So let me just open the gate wide. We need to hear from you just what the new theory is about.
I'm not sure I would call it a theory, but it is sort of a description of our current moment, political moment. And we call it calcification. And it's born of basically four things. And the first is that there is an increasing homogeneity within the parties, and that's Democrats and Republicans within the Democratic Party. People who call themselves Democrats are more like one another politically, possibly even descriptively, than they have been in the last several decades. So increasing sameness within parties, but also an increasing distance between the parties. So the two parties on average are separating, and we've seen that in Congress for a long time, but we're starting to see it now in the mass electorate as well. So that there's less commonality on average between the two parties. So those are the first two things: sameness within, distance between. And then the third component of calcification is this rise of identity-inflected issues to the top of the list of things that we're fighting over. So we're fighting politically now over things like immigration, separating children at the border, abortion, person-based issues, as opposed to maybe if you think of the 1980s or 90s, when we were fighting more over New Deal type of issues, the role and size of government, whether the government should provide health care. So those issues have fallen to be less important, and these identity-inflected issues are now more important to people. And then the last component that delivers us to calcification is a rough balance in the electorate between people who call themselves Democrats and people who call themselves Republicans. So a partisan parity in the electorate. And that's going to make the stakes of every election feel very high, because we're fighting over these person-based issues, and elections are turning on a knife's edge. And I should just say one last thing. that calcification, like it does in the human body, it makes things rigid and stiff, like it does with bones. So our politics has become inflexible, and there's just a rigidity to it that is derived from these four things that just happen to coincide at this moment in time.
So is it fair to say that what calcification means in practice is that individual voters tend to vote much the same all the time, and blocks of voters also tend to vote the same over and over again?
Yeah, and the easiest way to think about that is just think about party. People who call themselves Democrats, they're tending now to vote for Democratic candidates at every level of election, less ticket splitting. They're voting the same way over time as well, election after election, always for Democrats, more than we have seen in the recent past. And the same is true for Republicans.
I think back to prior to the 1960s, which I actually can think back to, and there used to be a lever in the voting machine that you could pull. And you didn't have to go, you didn't have to make up your mind about anybody. You pulled a lever, and you either pulled the Republican lever and you voted for 22 Republicans, or you pulled the Democratic lever and you voted for 22 Democrats. We're kind of sort of returning to that. We just got rid of the lever.
Yes. And there's a sense in which, you know, people would talk about that straight ticket voting as if it were a bad thing, that it was a non-thinking way of voting. And that led us into a period of time where people really focused a lot on the candidates as individuals, and that they were different and they maybe had different ideas from one another and different characteristics and experience and maybe levels of scandal or whatever. And that people should be voting for different parties at different levels of office, perhaps because the issues that the that elected official, you know, was dealing with would be very different, whether governor or city council, for example, president or city council. But straight ticket voting, as you've described it, it doesn't have to be a non-thinking way of voting. And for example, in the current moment of time, where, as I said, there's a lot of separation between the parties in terms of positions on issues or ideological orientation, then if you are a voter who knows the kind of world you want to live in, it's very easy for you to see, oh, that aligns with this party or that party. And it may not be non-thinking to vote a straight ticket. It's just that Democrats across all level of office now, president, governors, they tend to all have the same orientation toward the world and the same positions on issues. And so in some ways, you can be a thinking voter and still be doing this straight ticket voting.
Sure. If someone tells me whether they're a Republican or a Democrat, and they've told me a whole heck of a lot about themselves.
Yeah.
I may be wrong on some of the stuff, but I kind of sort of think I'm right on a bunch of the stuff.
You have a really good chance of knowing a pretty decent amount about their political orientation.
So there was one other aspect that you've discussed in the course of calcification that isn't just about voters and how they vote. It's a rigidity in the results of the elections. I think there was a comment you made that really struck me. And this was, I believe, not in the 2020 book, but it was afterwards. With Warnock's victory in Georgia, this was the first time in history that every incumbent senator won re-election. Hadn't happened ever until 2022. It's a kind of rigidity that occurred.
I don't remember saying that, but but that what you're talking about, the rigidity in outcomes, it's a very interesting part of this story, that as we've entered into this calcified political moment, we're seeing less volatility around outcomes. And that happens at the state level, for example. So there was a lot of reshuffling of states in 2016. One of the things that this calcified political moment delivers is a reduction in the volatility surrounding election outcomes. And so you can think about that happening at a lot of different levels. We could think about states. We could think about counties. They look more, their outcomes look more like they did the last time. And we can think about people. People tending to stick with the candidate they voted for the last time. And so that's all a product of this calcification. But it's also, remember I said about the partisan parity, the fact that the parties are in such balance in the electorate also means that outcomes are turning on almost anything, a very small number of voters. So this is a weirdness. At the same time that we're getting this reduction in the volatility of outcomes, we're also seeing that these elections are getting closer and closer and closer, so that really anything might flip an election from Democrat to Republican. And that whiplash is, I think, also very anxiety provoking for people, not knowing, not having a good sense of what's going to happen on election night.
So Donald Trump was elected president in 2016 because of the Electoral College structure. He won that election by 70,000 votes. And I'm doing this from memory. Joe Biden Yes. comes along in 2020. He wins the presidency once again because of Electoral College structure by 40,000 votes. Where could it be in 2024?
Well, you know, if you had to bet, why not bet in the 20s? You know, because that's sort of the pattern. And, you know, people like to push back whenever I cite these numbers. That's not the number of votes. You know, Biden won by hundreds of thousands, you know. But it's really important, the point that you made, the rules of the game are the rules of the game. And everybody knows the rules when they start. And the rules say that we're deciding these outcomes with the Electoral College, so state by state. And the numbers that you're citing are the number of voters within the states that it would have taken to flip the outcome to the other person. And yes, that number was like 44,000 votes in 2020. That is a really small number of voters. When you break that down into, you know, the three states that it would have taken to change the outcome, you're getting down into, you know, to 12,000 votes. So yes, these elections are turning on the knife's edge, and it makes it, you know, when people, what determined the outcome? Well, when we're talking about 10,000 votes, like, that literally could be anything.
Yeah. My uncle sneezed.
Hopefully not that.
So let me push back a bit on one aspect of this. You've described what the view is. And thank you for correcting me on the use of the term theory. I think I think your description of it as a description is powerful. It really has resonance. But here's something that I think people hear you say that I'm not sure you say.
Okay.
And that is that the role of the center, we've already started talking about the center, the role of the center seems missing in the four factors. It seems missing in the way a lot of the explanation pans out. It seems like our politics is in a kind of paralysis in which voters do not consider the merits of individual candidates. And that is because the center is gone. There are no moderates, no independents. If people hear those words coming from you, even though I don't think you have been saying those words.
That's right. Yes, we have not been saying those words. Certainly the role of candidates is important. You saw that in the midterm elections. People do pay attention to qualifications, to experience. And when we're talking about elections that are turning on so few votes, the quality of that candidate, that could be pivotal. So candidates, messaging, campaigning, advertising, getting out the vote, all of that stuff, it's not becoming less important. In many ways, it's as important as ever, if not more important, because we're really trying to get the last 1,000, 10,000 voters. As for the conversation about, you know, is the middle missing and where's the middle? You know, this is endlessly fascinating. And most people have a mix of liberal and conservative positions on issues. Very few people are all conservative or all liberal. But we can't fight politically about all issues. Moments in time provide us with things that we have to be talking about. COVID, for example, or conflict, or immigration, or abortion. So there, you can only fight about a set of things. You can't fight about everything. After the New Deal, there was a long period of time where we were fighting about those New Deal type issues. And on the things that rise to the top of the salience list, the impact, the high impact issues at any moment in time, most people will have liberal or conservative positions on those, even if they have cross positions on other things that are less important. So that doesn't mean that there are no moderates. In fact, most people are moderates. Most Democrats are moderates. Most Republicans will say they're moderates. It's sort of very useful to think about the six or seven things that each of these elections is turning on. And in that case, most voters have a clear alignment with one or the other party, even if ideologically they are not a super conservative or a super liberal.
And on top of that, the independents in our politics seem to be playing a very strong role. When they break toward Donald Trump, he becomes president. When independents broke for Joe Biden, he became president. And we've seen that play out over and over. And independents have grown in our society from a minuscule 20% when I was a kid growing up to, it's pushing past 40% these days, 41, 42% of the electorate. The largest single group of voters in the country are folks who say, I'm not a Republican, I'm not a Democrat, I'm an independent. What are your thoughts on their role?
So I think it's helpful to think about the 40% of people saying that they are independents by keeping in mind that when we push those people, do you lean toward one party or the other? Almost all of them will say they lean one way or the other. Very, very few people, when pushed, stick with the idea that they are an independent, single digits of people. The second thing I think is that it's really important not to conflate independents with moderates. So people who are ideologically in the middle of the road. People, the single digit, the 5, 6, 8, 9, whatever it is, percent of people who stick with that independent label after being given the chance to lean toward one party or the other, those people are less interested in politics. They vote less often. They're just not really politically involved relative to even the people who lean and are partisans. Moderates are not, that's not the case. As I said, most Democrats call themselves moderates, most Republicans. Moderates is a category of people that describes people with a mix of issue positions. But independent, that pure independent category, is really someone who is not as highly invested as politics as partisans.
So this is an issue that I've been discussing with Mo Fiorina of Stanford, who you know well.
Yes.
And Mo has a distinctive take on it. Do you want to play the lead on laying out how Mo sees that, or should I take a swat at it?
No, you should present Mo's argument.
I'll present Mo's view. Mo's view is that the leaners that you've discussed, I'm Wally, I'm polled. I'm asked, are you a Republican or a Democrat or an independent? I say, I'm an independent. And the pollster doesn't say, cool, let's go on to this and that topic. No, the pollster stops and says, you're an independent. Do you see yourself as closer to the Republican Party or the Democratic Party? And I give an answer. And then I'm characterized as a Republican leaner or a Democratic leaner. And the theory develops that there really is no essential difference between these folks and straight-line Republicans and Democrats, because they typically end up voting the way they told the pollster they leaned. Mm-hmm. And Moe's observation is the poll is taken at a particular point in time. There's an election coming up. Why couldn't it be, and it may well be, that the voter who is an independent has in mind that they're going to vote for Joe Biden, they're going to vote for Donald Trump in the coming election. I must be a Republican or I must be a Democrat. Makes sense for me to respond that way to the pollster. So it's Moe's way of reconstructing the validity of the initial answer, that the person may indeed really be independent, and the fact that they end up voting Democratic is their own prediction of how they were going to vote.
I seems completely possible to me. You know, survey research is a great tool, and I use it a lot. And it's always important to keep in mind that as carefully as we word these questions, we can only say on average, you know, this is how people are answering them. And it's very difficult to know why they're answering the way they're answering. And in this particular case, what Professor Fiorina is laying out is, in fact, just it would be very hard to unpack this with a survey at the same moment. Like, you would have to say to these people, now, are you just telling me you lean toward the Democratic Party because you think you're going to vote for Hillary Clinton in this election? You know, and then you're into this whole strange space where you're asking survey respondents to sort of self-analyze, which is never a great idea. So yes, all of this is a possible criticism. But, you know, let's just say that these initial independents really are different. They're certainly different from partisans in the just by observation, since they won't say they're a partisan. So in some way, they don't want to say, I'm a Democrat or Republican. And, you know, we could have a long conversation about why that might be. I think, you know, Mo and I tend to be on the same side of this. Maybe it's identity, but maybe it's not. But they're calling themselves independents. And these other people are willing to call themselves partisans. So they're different already. What does that mean in terms of elections? Well, does it really mean that those 40% of people are up for grabs in every election? Here's where panel data can help us out a little bit. So interviewing the same people over multiple waves. Let's say we have one of these people who says, I'm an independent, when you first ask them. But you also know that they've only ever voted for a Democrat, or they've only ever voted for a Republican. That's what we want to know from a voting analysis. I don't really care what they call themselves. Like, what I care about is this person someone who votes for Democrats or votes for Republicans or mixes their ballot or whatever? So not all those independents are flipping around Democrat, Republican, Democrat, Republican. Some of them really are regular party voters. But yes, it's possible that the answer they're giving in that moment is being driven by how they're seeing the upcoming election.
Yeah, it's interesting to me because, bluntly, because of the sheer size of the independent electorate. It just didn't exist when I became politically active many, many years ago. And it's interesting to me that we're still struggling to figure out who these folks are. We recognize, and there's not much dispute about this, that how they end up voting is determining who's winning the election over and over and over again.
I want to kind of add a wrinkle to that.
Please.
With elections becoming closer and closer, It's also possible that turning out your base is what's pivotal in the outcome. Getting the early vote out, getting people to turn in their mail-in ballots. Like, it's a little bit like the student who comes into my class. I've given them a B. And they come in and they say, Professor Vavrick, you are keeping me from going to law school because I get a B in your class. And well, no, what about all the other classes you got B's in when you were a freshman, right? Those certainly matter right now too, but you've forgotten about those. And so taking the base for granted, I think, is also problematic as elections get closer and closer. So yes, the independents are very important to the outcome, but literally so is everything else, every other form of electioneering.
So let's turn now, if you don't mind, to, I think we've laid a groundwork on the calcification view, and I wanted to go over it in detail for just the reason we've been discussing, that I think there's a tendency to misunderstand some of what you're saying. We just had this important election in 2022. It surprised a whole bunch of folks. There's good reason to believe one of the most surprised people in the country was Kevin McCarthy, who did not get a nice 30-vote margin for his majority. What's your view of calcification in the 2022 election?
I think when we look at the midterm elections in 2022, we see a lot of that same rigidity we talked about a moment ago at the state and county level. So district by district, there was less volatility than there has been in the past, meaning that the vote within district looked a lot like it looked in the last election. Less volatility. And that is about calcification. I also think that you saw instances where the candidates really mattered. And so that's important, too, when you talk about these elections getting closer and closer and the things that are determining outcomes. There are some really nice examples in 2022 where the candidates really made a difference. And so I would point to both of those things as key moments that illustrate some of the things we're talking about in the bitter end.
And independence in 2022?
You know, I haven't looked a lot at independent voters and what they did district by district. But I suspect that, as you say, they're sort of always predominantly with the winner.
Yeah, I'm in the same boat. I haven't seen a breakout of independents in the big crucial contest nationally. The figures I've heard is that the Republican turnout was about 3%. Over the Democratic turnout nationally, but independents broke for Democrats by somewhere between 2 and 3%. So they're in the mix, definitely. The split tickets in 2022 were dramatic. You had instances where voters in Georgia went to the polls as registered Republicans, promptly voted for Kemp for governor, and then went down the line to figure out who they were going to vote for senator, and either didn't vote for the Republican candidate, Herschel Walker, or ended up voting for Raphael Warnock. A true split-ticket situation. I haven't seen a completely reliable breakout of how large that might be, but the raw numbers of the Warnock vote, the Walker vote, the Kemp vote indicate there were a lot of Republicans who did something a lot like what I just laid out. So that's a split ticket behavior going on in a way that matters a great deal. Warnock was elected, and as someone pointed out, it was the first time in history every incumbent won. Any thoughts on your end about how split tickets play a role in this?
This story, what I like about it is, again, going back to the importance of candidates and campaigns. It's just a great illustration that voters are not blind. They are not just voting party. And here's an example where partisans decided to defect from their party to do what they thought was best for the common good. And you'll hear a lot of people saying that that doesn't happen. Voters aren't equipped to do that. And I just think that these examples that you've pointed to, especially this Georgia one, are really good examples of voters doing exactly that. Mm-hmm. So obviously, yes, the split ticketing is important, but not just because it's split ticketing and it's something to do. It's important because of what it tells us about the way voters are paying attention in these contests and to these contests and what they value.
And I mean, it's impossible to discuss the Georgia situation without starting to express my personal points of view. It's very hard to, how do you grapple with that? But the case to a Republican voter would have been pretty darn difficult to make about voting against the Republican candidate. The shift of power within the Senate was abrupt and important. And I think increasingly, you know, you've talked about how the changes as calcification moves forward. I think voters more and more realize their election is nationalized. They are voting for an individual person, but very much they're voting to select who's going to control the body into which this candidate goes.
Yeah, I think this is very interesting. And I think that I hope people will do some good work on this to try to figure out how much that is weighing on voters' minds, as opposed to lots of other plausible explanations that would also lead us to straight ticket voting. It's tricky to sort this out because there are so many reasons, you know, real, legitimate, solid reasons why people might always be voting for the same party. So, but certainly in a case like Georgia, the one that we've been talking about, you could believe that people are going to put a Republican in the Senate, no matter who that person is, because they know the Senate is close. And they know that how important it is to have control of, you know, a branch of the legislative chamber, if not two. And so in that circumstance, you could believe that it's plausible people had that in mind. But we don't really know if that's what people are thinking about. It's an open question, I think, and a very interesting one, how much the average voter has in mind the national political landscape when they're voting in their local election.
So let me wade into a different kind of a question along these lines. And I guess it came up in my mind because so many of the contests in 2022, the big senatorial contests in particular, were between Donald Trump-supported candidates and a candidate who a Democratic candidate who worked very hard to position themselves as some kind of a moderate. I'm thinking, once again, I'm talking about a lot about Raphael Warnock, but I keep thinking about the important, his campaign people talked about the importance that they presented Raphael Warnock truly as a pastor, not a radical advocate. So you had a pastor running against a MAGA-endorsed Donald Trump Republican to create a strong cleavage there. Do moderates do better in general?
Yes, really great question. And there's a bit of mixed evidence on this, but I think for a long time, the answer to that was yes. Moderate candidates, especially if we're thinking about something like the U.S. Congress, tended to do better than extreme ideological candidates in places where both of those candidates were viable in getting the nomination. So if you had a district where either one, an extreme candidate or a moderate, could have won the nomination, the moderate will tend to do better in the general election. And a lot of that comes from the fact that if the extreme candidate had won the nomination, they tend to really light up and mobilize the opposition. So the moderate candidate will do that less. So it's a little bit of a different finding than I think people expect. People think, oh, the moderate candidate just appeals to more people. Well, that's true. But the way that's sort of manifesting itself in the evidence is that that extreme candidate is mobilizing the opposition a lot more than the moderate in the general election. But people have continued to look into this. And in local races, city council, state legislatures, those kinds of races, they're not finding these differences. So I would say that there's a lot of reasons to think that that's true. Moderates tend to do better in general elections when both an extremist and a moderate are viable to get the nomination. But that effect may be waning.
So there was one aspect of the 2022 elections that struck me, and that was, as I was just saying, we had a host of candidates who swore fealty to Donald Trump, declared that the 2020 election was a fraud, and signed on to the full Trump agenda, and did not do very well. But was also striking was almost all of them, not all, but almost all of those candidates who lost their elections didn't deny the results of the election. It varied from person to person. Some came right out and made the traditional concession speech. Others said various reluctant things. And one candidate challenged the elections repeatedly in the legal system and lost. But there was no January 6th attempt. It's sort of unfashionable to have hope in these days. But I look at that and I wonder, does it mean that the fever is breaking?
I think it's hugely important. I don't know if it means the fever is breaking, but it does mean that democracy did not take one more step toward crumbling institutions. So I think it's very important. In fact, I think it's the most important thing that happened on election night in 2022. Imagine the world that we'd be living in if those candidates who lost said, march on the state house, march on the Capitol, bang down the door, take back the, you know, we'd really be in a very different place. And, I think it is hugely important that we saw basically none of that. And there was no traction for it. There was no calling for it. It wasn't difficult for these candidates not to do it. They behaved like the expectation of a candidate. Most of them conceded the election. None of them called on their supporters to take up arms. I don't know if it means the fever's breaking. The fever, I think of the fever as being all wrapped up in the calcification. The stakes of elections seem very high to people because the worlds that the Democrats and Republicans want to build are very different from one another. And voters, in 2022, they know what kind of world they want to live in on those top five or six things that we're talking about. So a little bit of, quote unquote, the fever, I think, comes from that. And I don't see that going away.
How do you place moderates in that formulation? I really do agree with you. The two parties are very distinct. They have very well-defined points of view. They are ideologically consistent in a way that never existed before. We can think back to the time when the American, what is the name of your association? The American Association of Political Scientists denounced the ideological inconsistency of American
right.
voters. Well, that's gone. Now we have consistency of the parties,
yes.
at any rate. So it is absolutely true. Folks can imagine what the world will be or would be. If this person gets an off. But for moderates,
as you were sort of wading in, it's a bit different. Position on abortion may be one way. Position on the government's deficit may be another way. And there may be identity issues on which there are other things. So it's not, for a moderate, is it about the world or is it a different kind of thought process?
The way I think about this, it's always about the world you want to live in. So, and remember that most people have liberal and conservative positions on issues. Very few people are all liberal or all conservative. So the question is on the five or six things that candidates are fighting about in this election. Do you have a mix of positions or all? Do you want to build a wall on the southern border? Do you want to impeach Donald Trump? Do you want to allow Dreamers to become citizens, separate children from their families at the border? Do you want to allow religious bans on entry into the country? Those, you know, do you think abortion should be legal? Those five or six things were the most important things to people when they thought about 2020 and the world they wanted to live in. And on that set of things, those person-based issues, people really do tend to fall one way or the other. Now, that doesn't mean that they don't have, if they take the liberal position on those issues, many of which are related, building the wall, Dreamers becoming citizens, those are related. So like, yeah, they're going to have liberal positions on all those things. That doesn't mean that they don't have a position on raising taxes or the Green New Deal or trade that is counter to the Democratic Party. They might, but we're not talking about those things. We're not fighting about those things. So for a quote unquote moderate, someone who maybe even has half liberal and half conservative positions, what really matters is what are your positions on the top five or six things that we're fighting over right now? Now, if someone really did want to build a wall, think abortion should always be legal, think Dreamers should become citizens, but want a Muslim, like that's an unusual collection. And yeah, for that person, you know, maybe they're going to have to decide based on candidate characteristics or which one of those things is the most important to them. But I don't think fundamentally it makes the decision untenable for them. Maybe they just reduce it to the top two things or the top three things.
Let me make a confession about a personal fear I have about the views of polarization and calcification. And my fear is that it says that the country is becoming ungovernable, that there is no reliable prospect that let's just talk about the worlds. I really like your description, your use of the word world to encompass things. It really does resonate and it makes sense. And the ideological consistency flows into that. So I'm a voter. I'd love to vote for my party's candidate. I would love for my candidate to win this year. I know that it isn't going to happen overnight. We're in this calcified political situation in which we've seen the presidency exchange hands with volatility and with the policies shifting 180 degrees very rapidly. I don't think there's an American who believes that if one bill is passed by one president, it will stay intact and will govern our society for the next generation. The fear then is that we become ungovernable because our politics is volatile, endlessly changing, and as you're pointing out, endlessly changing on the whims of very few voters who are making the crucial differences. So I just sort of have to get that off my chest. I'm not a political scientist. I try to be objective about these issues, but
I'm not. I like a lot of American citizens, I care a whole heck of a lot about what's going on. And that is one of my real fears. Do you, in your theories or in your descriptions, is there room for hope?
Well, tell me what you mean by ungovernable.
What I mean is that the presidents have been able to have a program, been able to have a unified government where they can implement a program for about the first 2 years of their presidencies. And then, like Joe Biden, they lose their majority in one or another house. They become a president who issues press releases, tinkers with executive orders around the fringes, and that's it. Maybe, maybe in the next election, they could be reelected. They could have a unified government and once again return to the governance program that was part of their original vision of the world they could create. That it's very specific and it's very real. It is the loss of power abruptly, the inability to think back to things like the Roosevelt era, where we had a president who would initiate programs, build on them, reject ones that don't work, put in new ones over and over and over again, over a decade's period. I don't want a president back for a decade, but that's what I mean by the volatility of it.
Well, I think, yes, I think there's reason to be somewhat optimistic, but one of the things that I think about when you think about this gridlock, which is, I think, part of what you're talking about, like paralysis to get things done, is the difference between New Deal issues and identity-inflected issues in terms of what's possible with bargain and compromise. So one of the things you hear people say is like the art of politics is fading from politics. And what they mean is that the ability to bargain and compromise to move policy a little bit, maybe not as far as you want, but a little bit, like that's going away. And part of what I think is challenging about doing that in an era where the things we're fighting over are these identity-based issues is, let's take building a wall on the southern border. That's a lot different than what should the tax rate be on small businesses. So we're either going to build the wall or we're not. There's no, we're going to build a wall, but instead of it being 8 feet, it's only going to be 4 feet. Right. There's no, oh, we're going to build a wall, but only on these 200 miles, not the, you know, it's either, it's an all or nothing. There's no policy in the middle that makes any sense compared to what should the tax rate be on, you know, people earning above $200,000 a year. That's a continuum. And you could see people bargain. You want it to be this. I want it to be this other thing. Let's meet in the middle. Okay. I can live with that. You can live with that. And it's a sensible policy position. But these identity inflected things, they don't have a middle. Should same-sex couples be allowed to be legally married or not? There's no, oh, let's let them be legally married on Mondays and Tuesdays, but not Wednesdays and Thursdays, right? It's not sensible. And so that is part of the reason that it seems like the art of bargaining and compromising isn't important to people. It's not something they want to do. It's not so maybe so much that. It's just these set of issues make it very difficult to engage in that kind of art. But it's not going to be this way forever, probably. So to answer your question about, you know, is there room for optimism? You know, like we did fight over the New Deal issues for decades and decades, and we might be fighting over these identity issues for decades and decades. There are more to come. Immigration and abortion seem very central right now, but gender politics and gender identity politics and bathrooms and sports teams, and I think all of that is yet to come from a policy perspective. And so we've got a lot more of this to get through. Maybe it's going to be decades, but maybe something else will come along and dislodge these identity issues as the core battle that we're fighting over. It isn't easy to think of what that thing could be, war in Europe between Russia and other countries, possibly. Nobody's hoping for that. That's not very optimistic. So, you know, the best I can do is that these are very tough issues. Public opinion really continues to change. That could be one way that it is not so contentious. But I don't think, you know, things change and this will change too. It's just hard to know when that will happen.
Well, let me offer one thought, and I really like your way of phrasing that the identity issues, such as the border wall, simply are not compromisable issues. You're either for it or against it. But if you step back from the border wall and just look at the whole immigration situation, or on abortion, if you step back from some particular proposal and look at the whole question of rights, then I think you can find areas, and this is a way you could move away from the uncompromisable nature of things. You could look for issues within immigration that are subject to compromise. How many folks come across the border legally? Under what circumstances? How aggressive will we be about encouraging the immigration of folks into the United States who we think deserve it because they are refugees or because they have engineering degrees? Those are, so here you are, you're talking about immigration. You've adopted Donald Trump's general issue, but you've moved it into a realm that, as you were saying, is negotiable. You can start seeing conservative Republicans making productive proposals along those lines, and you could start seeing Democrats engaging on those. On abortion, the fact that Roe v. Wade, the national law, is gone, we're now seeing states one by one fight enormously over the details of what is going to happen. But in a number of places, that struggle, that political struggle, has not been over banning abortions completely or opening the door wide with no restrictions whatsoever. State after state is saying, here's how we want to approach it. So I would throw out as a, this isn't one policy or one issue or one program. It's a way of approaching all of the policies that could be more productive. Don't get sucked into the identity politics that is attached to one particular way of phrasing it and can be exploited by a guy like Donald.
Yeah, I think that's right. And that's where political leadership and political entrepreneurs are really important. How will we package this set of policies? You know, how will we frame the choice for people? And in a world where there's partisan balance in the electorate and elections are turning on very few votes, I think the incentive is there for candidates to try to draw pretty distinct lines between them. And, you know, one of the surest ways to make an issue not salient in an election campaign is to have both candidates agree on the position. So I've been thinking about this a lot lately with the classified documents. So now we've got classified documents appearing on the Republican and the Democratic side of the aisle outside of the White House. Everyone is worried about what does this mean for 2024? And my initial thought was, no sure way to make this not be a concern in 2024 than to have both sides have the same problem or position on this.
And a really terrific position would be silence.
Well, this is what this is my prediction. Who is going to want to talk about this? Not the people on the right, not the people on the left. So So the flip of that is that if you want to have something, if something is going to emerge as a salient feature of a campaign, you have to believe you're on the side that most voters are on, right? You have to have benefit from your position. And you have to know that your opponent is stuck in an unpopular other position. If you don't know that, they can come take the same position as you and they can split the votes with you. So candidates tend to talk about things in campaigns where they feel like they're advantaged and their opponent is far from them. And so that is why you get things like build a wall. It's very easy to distinguish yourself. And 100% Trump knows that the Democrat is not going to come out and say, well, yes, let's talk about where we're going to build that wall. 100% knows that. So it's a, for sure, he thinks he's closer to most voters on this. And so he knows that this is going to be a winner for him. This is sort of his thinking. And so that's how you get these kind of hyperbolic black and white issues emerging, and why you don't see more sensible framing of, you know, let's talk about the number of people and let's talk about, you know. So I think the nature of the competition and the closeness of the electorate are playing into that a little bit as well.
One of the most interesting discussions for me in your book was your analysis of how Trump's positions moved the Democratic electorate on immigration issues and on black rights issues. And the observation that was fascinating to me was Trump's over-the-top positions had very little effect on his Republican electorate. They liked it, but not, you know, it didn't shift them in any way on the underlying issue themselves. Democrats, on the other hand, took it as a cue as to what the heck was going on in the real world and moved strongly to a much more liberal position on immigrant rights and a much more liberal position on black Americans' rights. What's going to happen in 2024, Lynn?
Well, I don't know, Wally. You know, I don't think there's any sign that any of that is slowing down. There's increasing, this is part of the increasing distance between the parties that we were talking about, largely driven by Democrats becoming on average more and more liberal on these person-based issues as a party. And so, you know, those gaps are not going away. They're not going to revert to an equilibrium. I think this is a permanent gap on these issues. And so that will be, you know, what does that mean, given what we talked about a moment ago? That means that these issues on which there are big differences between the parties become very ripe fruit to pick for candidates when they want to distinguish between themselves. And, you know, I suspect that many of them will emerge again in 2024. You know, people want to talk about inflation and interest rates and, you know, maybe there will be a bit of that, but I will say that I will be a little bit surprised if the 2024 presidential campaign does not have a component, an identity component to it. I think it will. These issues are, there's too much difference between the party and they're very salient for people.
So we can look forward to CNN and Fox's ratings going up.
I guess.
Thanks for joining us. I've been wanting
Thank
to talk
you for
to
having
you,
me.
Wanting to talk to you for a year, for years actually, and wanting to engage on these issues. Are you planning another book?
At this point, we do not have plans. So, I mean, there will be more books, but we do not have a plan for a 2024 election book. Maybe it'll be something a little bit different, but at the moment, I think no election book.
Well, I just want to tell you how fabulous the 2022 result was. It's a fascinating, it is a fascinating book.
Thank you.
And we've dealt on one big theory in the book. But what's wonderful about it is how you deal with concern after concern, event after event, and find a way of grappling with it that makes a lot more sense than mere commentary. It really turns, it becomes a Bible to analyze what took place and what the heck it was all about.
Well, that is an incredible compliment. Thank you. And I'm glad that you found it interesting and useful. And I will just say that at this point in before the 2020 election, so in 2019, we didn't have any plans to write a 2020 election book. So anything is possible.
Well, just know there are folks out there rooting to buy it and read it and underline it like crazy.
Oh, well, thank you. Okay, well, that will surely factor in.
How the independents vote has determined the outcome of many recent crucial elections. So understanding them becomes of paramount importance. You'll notice that Professor Vavrick and I did not come to agreement on how to best to describe the independents in our politics. That pretty well summarizes the status of academic understanding on that topic. It seems truly strange to say this, but American political scientists have not figured out how to come to agreement on just who the independents are. The majority of the Academy adheres to the view, which Vavrick explained, that the vast majority of independents are really hidden Republicans or hidden Democrats, with only a tiny minority of true independents who really are depoliticized know-nothings incapable of being a political force. If you agree with that view, then the Gallup poll tells you that today 42% of all voters say they are independent. But when Gallup pushes them and asks if they are closer to one or another party, 16% of all voters are independents who say they lean toward the Democratic Party. 17% of all voters are independents who say they lean toward the Republican Party. And only 9% of all voters are true independents who aren't leaners. In short, there really aren't many real independents at all. But others in the academic world think that independent leaners are highly volatile and can switch from their leaning preference to the rival party. Still other academics think that independent leaners retain their allegiance to the leaning preference, but are unreliable voters and may or may not turn out in the elections. Confused by it all? You should be. Our political scholars are all over the map. I'd like to end by pointing out some of Vavrick's distinctive ideas that really got my attention. Her conviction that voters are deeply concerned with the kind of world they want to live in had real resonance for me. I take it that she means we all sense the worldview of each of the two parties, the purpose, the direction, the goal of the society that each side envisions. It includes but goes beyond the specific issues of the day, and we cast our votes for one or another world that we would like to live in. Finally, Vavrick brings us a warning. The rise of identity issues has given birth to calcified politics in which elections turn on a knife's edge and have deeply important consequences because the two parties, rival rulers, have such a different view of the world they would construct. And, she warns, we are just beginning that process. 2024 will see more and more identity issues rise up to divide us. I want to thank Lynn Vavrick for taking time with us, and as always, my producer Anna Kumu for her excellent work. Next time I'll have the third conversation on the significance of the 2022 election. I'll be talking with Joan Williams, who wrote White Working Class, 4 months after Donald Trump's astonishing victory in 2016. Her book was a searing criticism of the Democratic Party's abandonment of what had been its electoral base in past decades. I'll ask her to address the 22 election and the election in 2024 that lies ahead of us. I'll see you next time on The Political Conversation.